You're listening to the Rogues Radio Podcast, your home for creator interviews, comic book reviews, industry news and commentary, and the Retro Retrospective Movie Review Show. Welcome you to this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. My name is Dave Beatty, and I'm one of your hosts. For the last almost nearly 30 years, I've been a professional illustrator and graphic designer. I worked on a lot of fun things some people have heard on, things like Justice League of America, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, X-Men. Also some things people maybe haven't heard about, like Irredeemable, for example. But anyhow, enough about that. I want to welcome back my co-host. This is Mr. Eric Alexander. Eric, please tell the folks a little bit about what you've done as a creative professional.
Thank you. Yes, I am actually the associate producer for a feature film called Occupants, which is currently available for free on Tubi. I also was the publisher and editor for the official Occupants comic book tie-in, and I am the chief financial officer of Bad Bob Productions.
So it's time for the TV and news roundup segment. So tell me, Eric, is there anything interesting happening in the world of TV or movie news?
Yeah, well, of course, during our little hiatus there, while we weren't recording, New York Comic Con happened. Now, Dave, have you actually ever been to New York Comic Con?
No, I have not.
Okay, so I have not either, and it's one of the ones that I definitely have wanted to check out. I have heard from some folks that are kind of burnt out on San Diego that New York is kind of, although it's kind of going in the same direction as San Diego, it's not quite as bad, and it's a little bit more fun. Now, that may be changing, because it seems like the reputation of New York Comic Con as a media event is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Case in point, we had quite a bit of Star Trek news come out of New York Comic Con. They actually had a panel on Discovery. They had a panel related to that with the short treks. And then they also had a Picard panel, and there was quite a bit of interesting news out of that. Disco Discovery did have a new trailer come out. Dave, did you happen to check that out?
I did.
So,
I thought it looked interesting. I'm a little confused by. I guess it's just one of those things that I'm not sure. I mean, well. As always with Discovery, it's like I'm looking forward to watching it because I do enjoy the show for what it is. I like season two better than season one, and I'm curious to see what they do in season three. But I'm not a big fan of, you know, they zipped to the future and the Federation's gone or suffering, or I don't know. I'm not too keen on that. So we'll have to see how they pull that together or what they do with it.
Somebody mentioned, and I thought this was pretty interesting, but somebody in the Twitterverse out there mentioned that they're ripping off Andromeda. What do you think of that?
Yeah, they're definitely taking some inspiration from that, I'd have to say.
That was my initial reaction. Now, I'll put the caveat out there. Anybody who's listened before knows this, but just in case, I haven't watched all of Discovery. I've seen the pilot, because that was actually on CBS, the regular broadcast channel. I saw the pilot for Discovery, and I also saw the first episode of the second season, where they introduced Anson Mount as Captain Pike. I saw that because they put it on YouTube, which I still think was a little weird. It was kind of interesting that they put that on YouTube, because to me, YouTube is a competitor of CBS All Access, especially with YouTube Red. So I did see those, and I'm aware of a lot of the spoilers. I've seen a lot of reviews on both sides. I do affiliate with people that like Discovery, so I know their views as well. And so I know a lot of spoilers. I'm a spoiler-heavy kind of guy. But it seems to me, the interesting thing about season three is you almost, at least for the setup, you almost wouldn't even have to have watched the previous two episodes to really know what's going on, because they're so far in the future. It's kind of like whatever they did before doesn't really matter. What do you think about that, Dave?
Yeah, I'd have to say that's probably true, because they have gone so far into the future that you probably could come into season three and pretty much be all right. I mean, if you were curious to learn more about the characters, you've got two seasons you can go back and explore. Because one of the things, too, is I'm not sure as the show went that they were trying to get away from that concept a little bit. You know what I mean? Because that's the one piece of technology they have that's unique and really futuristic that maybe no one in that time period has. But beyond that, in a weird way, they should be theoretically in an antiquated ship with antiquated weapons. So, I mean, to me, it's kind of making me think more of Enterprise. You know, they should theoretically be way out of their element, but I don't know. We'll have to see.
One thing I found striking on the visual side is, of course, there's a huge amount of controversy about the revisualization of the Klingons in Discovery. It's something that's extremely polarizing for fans. And I noticed there is a scene in the new Discovery trailer where they pretty much like have a who's who of Star Trek aliens. There's even a person that's from Morn species from DS9. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I did.
And there's an Andorian. There's a Cardassian. And they all look exactly the same from the previous iterations. So it really makes me wonder about the behind the scenes and these kind of, I think, phony justifications we've gotten as to why the Klingons are different in Discovery, because those guys were carbon copies of what we've seen before.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, because they're kind of in the future, like on the other side of Next Gen and stuff, I'm thinking that probably the Klingons should look like traditional Klingons by now. Unless they have another story or something they want to do with it. I mean, in my mind anyway, they should just be classic-looking Klingons now.
Well, I just think it's funny that with the other aliens, because I don't think they've shown Cardassians, and certainly not Morn's race. I don't even know what Morn's race is in Discovery. You would know better than me about that. But as far as I know, they haven't ever shown them in Discovery up to this point. And those versions, I mean, they're straight off the Deep Space Nine set.
No, yeah, I mean, the few that they've shown, like the Andorians, I mean, they looked pretty much like they were out of Enterprise. I mean, they it should, in my mind anyway, it should all sync up, so, at least by now.
So then we also had the short treks, which I didn't get a chance to see. I don't have CBS All Access. I understand that you did see the short trek, though.
Yeah, I watched Q&A, and I liked it. I really like everything they've been doing with the sort of the Pike era Enterprise crew. I kind of liked it for what it was. I enjoyed it. Yeah, I've been enjoying everything. Anything that involves the Enterprise crew and Discovery, I've been really enjoying it. I really like Rebecca Romaine as number one. It's interesting because she's because I read, I can't remember the name of it. They did a series of around the anniversary, they did a series of new novels, and they had one that was mostly all about Number One, actually. And there was a lot of stuff about her being very logical and kind of, you could, I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to actually the next one. I think the next one's going to be probably the biggest departure in my mind, because it looks like it's going to be very much like a comedy. Because the next one is, I can't remember her name. It's the Rosa Salazar, the actress who played Alita in Battle Angel Alita, is going to be starring in the next one with H. John Benjamin, who I'm a huge fan of, or John H. Benjamin. I'm not sure exactly. Based on John Benjamin, he is the voice of Coach McGurk from Home Movies. Character has just been promoted to captain, so she's taking over as captain of a new Federation starship, and it looks pretty silly and fun. But since we're getting ready to do Lower Decks and stuff like that, it makes sense that they would do stuff a little bit just more straight comedy. But as far as how well it fits with Trek, I won't know until I watch it.
Well, I saw the trailer for that, and I already have a huge issue with that, because very clearly in the Tribbles episode and the original series, Uhura has no idea what a Tribble is, and now they're just acting like everybody knows what Tribbles are. And yeah, that's the kind of stuff that just really irks me as a hardcore Star Trek fan. The other thing I just want to comment on is, since I haven't seen the short Trek with Rebecca Romijn as Number One, I do think that it's interesting as far as the analytical take on Number One makes sense, because all we have is what's in the cage, and that's definitely implied in the cage. With Spock, the cage is kind of a throwaway, you know, and I say that because the fact of the matter is nobody really knew what Spock was supposed to be when they made the original pilot. And actually, that's the Menagerie technically, right? So when they made the Menagerie, nobody knew what Spock was supposed to be. There's actually a great roundtable discussion. I believe it's called the Captain's Chair or something like that, or the Captain's Roundtable. And it's Leonard Nimoy with William Shatner, and then also Patrick Stewart with Jonathan Frakes, and Whoopi Goldberg hosts it. Have you ever seen that one? Okay, it's on YouTube. I highly suggest it. I believe it's actually was meant as to complement one of the releases of The Next Generation. And there is a moment where Leonard Nimoy talks about the cage, and specifically the infamous smile. Okay, that's a big thing. It's a big thing for Trek fans. It's a big source of debate, all sorts of things. And Leonard Nimoy says very, very straight that, hey, the only reason I did that was because the guy playing Pike was so straight. I mean, I felt I had to do something like that. Once Shatner was cast, he's like, he didn't feel like he had to do that. He didn't feel like he had to balance Shatner in that way as an actor. So I just kind of want to throw that out there, because it seems to me like what they're doing in the Discovery versions of Spock and Pike, and to a certain extent, is what they're doing is they're taking stuff that wasn't really ever meant to even be a big part of Trek, and they're amplifying it. Me seeing Spock smile when he's not under the influence of something just makes me cringe as a hardcore fan, personally. And so I just want to throw that out there as far as the little fan debates and quibbles that we get into, because those things do irritate me. Now, I'll be watching all this stuff once Picard comes out, all right? I'll be watching all of this just because I want to watch it and I want to have an informed opinion. And that does lead to the last segment of the Star Trek panel from New York Comic Con, which is at Picard, showed their trailer as well. Now, have you had a chance to see the Picard trailer?
Yes, I have.
What was your reaction to it?
I enjoyed it. I think it looks interesting. I mean, it's weird because I wonder how much time, like, Brent Spiner and Jonathan Frakes had to kind of prepare, you know what I mean, to be on this.
I would say zero.
Yeah, because it seems like, I don't know, I mean, because that's the only thing, like, the shot of Data is a little jarring, you know what I mean? Beyond that, I don't have any issues with Jonathan Frakes, you know what I mean? Because it kind of fits when you see that he's, you know, basically at home and cooking and whatever. But no, I mean, I liked the trailer. I thought it kind of hit me in the feels when his daughter is, you know, screaming that Jean-Luc Picard is here, and he turns around and sees, you know, Picard standing there. You know what I mean? That's fun. The other elements seem to kind of reinforce kind of what we sort of knew. They're going to explain to us or show us some, or I don't know. We're going to learn more about the Romulan rescue mission that went horribly wrong that sets up the first Kelvin timeline, you know what I mean, Star Trek movie. And then I guess that somehow explains why Picard's just on the Vineyards essentially in retirement. And then there was a shot I'm not hearing anyone talk about that I was kind of thrown off by. Did you see that shot where it's like someone in a jumpsuit, but they look almost like they could be like a Sung android with no hair? Did you notice that?
Yeah. I have a interpretation of that I think is pretty simple. That's one of the Borg test subjects. We've seen that jumpsuit before in the previous trailer. The Borg that are being experimented on by the Romulans and the Borg cube, they wear these sort of orange jumpsuits.
It's just kind of weird because it looks like a Sung era android more than a Borg.
Well, it's very possible, especially with Hugh and the storyline with Lore, that's exactly the direction they might have gone in.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. So no, I mean, I like the trailer. It looks interesting. I'm looking forward to the show anyway. So I'm curious to see what they do with it. I think there probably is some truth to that rumor going around, though, that Picard's not going to make it out. And I think now it's just a debate of, like, is it the first season or second season? So, and then the ship may wind up being named Picard. So,
yeah, I'd be pretty upset I'll be very upset if that's what happens. But I will say this. I've said that I'm cautiously optimistic about Picard. I still am. Now, when the first trailer came out, to be honest, I was probably more optimistic than I was cautious. Now I actually am more cautious than I am optimistic, and this is the reason why. So I did get some of the comments that were made by the panel for the Picard panel at New York Comic Con. And I believe one of the – I don't know exactly who said this. I don't know if it was Kurtzman or Chabon or who it was, but somebody mentioned specifically that Picard is not supposed to be a reunion show. They said very specifically that we're choosing people to bring back because they offer something compelling to the story. Did you hear something like that too, Dave?
I'll be honest with you. I didn't watch any of the Q&A panels for the New York show. I don't have a good reason for why other than I just didn't watch them.
Well, this was from an article sort of like summarizing the panel. Okay.
I mean, I've been kind of trying to stay away from some of the spoiler stuff, but I am still kind of getting exposed to some of it. No, I'm not familiar with this quote that you're referencing.
Okay, so yeah, this isn't a spoiler at all. This is just people asking about, you know, hey, well, I want to see my favorite. You know, I like Worf. Is Worf going to be in it? Oh, I like Janeway. Is Janeway going to be in it? That's kind of what goes on, you know. And right. So they're addressing that concern by saying, hey, well, listen, we're having these people specifically because it advances the story that we're trying to tell. It's not supposed to be a reunion show. And to be honest, seeing the second trailer, it looks like a reunion show. You know, we have another image of Data. We already know Data was going to be in it. The thing that kind of irritates me is we now know that Data's in there basically as a dream. I mean, I don't think there's any way you talk about spoilers. The spoiler's right there in the trailer. So now that seems to be confirmed from the trailer that he is just a dream, some sort of manifestation of Picard's mind, which is something we could have found out in the show. They don't need to show that in the trailer. We have additional scenes, obviously, of Seven of Nine. We also have our first scenes of Hugh, and which, by the way, Hugh was a little jarring to me because it's like he has less Borg implants than Seven. So that'll be interesting if they decide to explain that, because I'm not quite getting it, especially when he's supposed to be on his own little Borg colony where they're just all bored, but who knows what's going on with the situation there. Then we also have the scenes of Troy and Riker. And it was like, to me, I'm sitting there like, we already knew that they're going to be in the show. Why are you showing us the reunion in the trailer? So I've said this before, the marketing of Picard prior to the first trailer really confused the heck out of me. The whole Picard or Star Trek Vineyards thing really just confused the heck out of me. Then the first trailer came out and I was like, oh, okay. All right. I guess it's true. They probably did go through some reshoots and decided to retool some things. And this is looking pretty good. But then the second one, I'm confused again because they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. On the one side, they're saying it's not a reunion show. It's not just about bringing back all these alum and all that kind of stuff. Yet that's what the second teaser was. The second trailer was a reunion show.
Well, and I'm curious too because it's been a while since I've read it, but there's a graphic novel or a comic book series called Countdown. Are you familiar with Countdown?
Yes, I am familiar with it, and I have the first and the fourth issue of Countdown, which I think, by the way, at some point, I think you and I are going to do some sort of prelude to Picard because the air date has been released. It's what, January 23rd? Does that sound right?
Yeah, sounds right. I think Countdown would be a good thing to, you know, read and review for the show. Definitely as a sort of like a prerequisite before we talk about Picard, just because that's the only thing we currently have that really is supposed to kind of take place in that timeline. Again, looking at, you know, the attempted rescue mission on you know, the Romulan homeworlds that went wrong, right? That led to the destruction, which of course had Spock and Nero and all that stuff from the Kelvin timeline. But it's weird to me because I don't understand why Data would just be a vision in Picard's mind when, if you read Countdown, and I'm going to say this is not a spoiler, but if you're not familiar with Countdown, maybe this is a spoiler. Data is the current captain of the Enterprise in Countdown. And it's the B4 body, and basically the Data memory engrams have kind of taken over. So that basically, in a sense, Data is back. He's the captain of the new Enterprise during the Countdown story. So I don't understand why for Picard he would just be a memory if he was still around. It's not like Data died at the end of Nemesis and is still dead. If all this connects into the Kelvin timeline, then theoretically Data is still technically out there in some form.
Yeah, I think they're throwing that out the window. That's my prediction right there, is that that premise has been completely negated. Brent Spiner has said that he is playing Data. He said specifically he's not playing B4, which if you go by Countdown, it's actually the same person. Data and B4 are the same thing, essentially, in Countdown. The implication is that the android that's all pulled apart in the first trailer, that's probably B4. That's the speculation. You know, I think it would be really cool if it was Lore, or if they brought Lore in as a major thing. But honestly, again, it goes right back to my first concern. I think this is all kind of reunion stuff that's going on, and unfortunately, I don't think Data is going to have a big role in this. I don't think Riker's going to have a big role in this. I don't think Troy's going to have a big role in this. Seven of Nine may have a more substantial role in this. We'll have to see. Hugh, that's completely up in the air. But the other thing that really confuses me is we're not seeing a whole lot about these new characters either. You know, it's supposed to be about this big new ensemble. There's all sorts of other characters, and we still know nothing about them.
Yeah, that's true.
So again, the marketing confuses the heck out of me. Am I going to be there? Oh, yeah. Are we going to talk about it on this show? Oh, yeah. But I'm just telling you, I have concerns.
Yeah, what?
I'm just telling you, I have concerns.
No, yeah, and I do too. That's what I'm saying. The first couple of trailers, I was really excited for it, and I'm still excited for it. But I'm very, very confused, like you, because it's like, well, wait a minute. Like, this doesn't sync up, because if we are essentially, you know, reflecting and showcasing, at least at the beginning of this, these events that sent Picard basically into retirement, which is the same events that send Nero and Spock basically back in time and basically create the Kelvin timeline, then I don't know. Hopefully it'll all make sense when we watch it.
I think they're gonna fudge a little bit with all that kind of stuff. Because I always tell this. Actually, I got into a debate with somebody about this very, very recently on Twitter. It actually got kind of heated and even got kind of personal, which, again, I've said many times, guys, don't make it personal. Just because you don't like my argument or something like that, I promise I won't get personal with you if I don't like your argument. There's no reason to get personal. But someone got really heated with me because I made the point, you know, you've always got to take the books and the comics with a grain of salt. You've always got to do that, especially when you're talking about a property that is based on the show. In other words, the show came first. You know what I mean? The show is the main thing. So what happens on screen, that's the stuff that we can really kind of consider canon. Everything else is supplemental. And we've been down this road so many times. I have friends that were so into the expanded universe of Star Wars, and look how that got trashed.
Right, and I understand that, but the only difference, it's the big thing that makes this difference specifically with Countdown is Countdown was sold, marketed, and is a direct lead-in to the was it 2009, the J.J. Abrams, the first Star Trek movie that basically establishes the Kelvin timeline.
Yeah, but they've done this before. In fact, every large property has done this. They've always had comic adaptions and comic book tie-ins. I think I remember talking to you on our Battlestar Galactica episode. There's a version of the Battlestar Galactica pilot, basically, where Commander Cain is there. And that doesn't make any sense because in the TV show, we find out that Commander Cain was actually part of a completely different lost fleet. See what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's
no,
like these comics, they always, again, I just have to say the books, whether the comic books or the novelizations, they always have to kind of be taken with a grain of salt because bottom line is the producers and the directors don't care about that stuff. They just don't. You know what I mean?
No, I understand that, and I'm not arguing the opposite very heavy. I'm just saying that the only reason I bring it up in this particular instance is because Countdown is supposed to technically be more a part of, I guess you want to call it, the Kelvin canon or timeline than normal because it does directly lead into the movie. So obviously they can throw that stuff away and do whatever they want to do. But I was kind of really hoping at some point we'd get a shot, even just briefly, of Data on the bridge of the new Enterprise as the captain.
And that's what I was hoping, too, when I first heard, because there was some comments from San Diego Comic-Con where Patrick Stewart had said, yeah, you know, I insisted basically on wearing the uniform. I wanted to have a scene where I have the uniform. Well, we saw it in the trailer. He said that there was going to be a scene. He wanted to have a scene where he was in uniform. Well, there it is.
I know, and that I just, and see, that goes back to my one thing about the Picard thing from the beginning. It's just I don't know. It seems like in all the shows we're creating environments and situations where people are just out of uniform, and the Federation is there but not. And I mean, if you look at Discovery, through all the. I forget, 930 years in the future, whatever it is, the Federation's there, but not.
Well, it sounds like it's not there. That's what I took from the trailer, is that there is no Federation anymore.
And then it turns into this thing where it's like, well, then they don't necessarily have to be in uniform anymore, do they?
Nope.
And that's the thing I don't want. I don't want a ragtag group of people tearing across space having adventures, because that's Star Wars.
It also would be really crazy if Discovery and Picard are both would be really odd,
and that's the thing. And it's like, well, what are the shows that are gonna be like, have characters in uniform and be kind of more in canon? I mean, is Lower Decks gonna be more Trek than the live action shows? Like, that's gonna be weird. So I
can see it going in that direction. I was actually pretty impressed with the Lower Decks panel at Star Trek Vegas. They seem to be like real fans, and that might be what happens.
That's just going to be so crazy, because it's In a weird way, it's almost creating a similar dynamic with what's going on kind of in the Star Wars fandom, because you have those people that love Clone Wars, right? And then you have and a lot of people that quite liked Rebels. But then you turn around and the live action stuff, it's leaving them cold. So it's just, I don't know. It's going to be weird and interesting. And I guess we'll just have to see where we are. The things that I'm still not getting used to that's come across in the Picard trailers, it's just the ragtag group of people having adventures out in space thing. I mean, I love all the classic, you know, Trek iconography. You know, I want everyone to have standard issue phasers. I want comm badges or communicators. Like, I want, because the problem is, the more you introduce just random stuff, in my mind anyway, the more you take away the things that make it unique, identifiable, and in my mind, those are the things that make it a franchise. You know, for example, I keep coming back to Space 1999. When I think about Space 1999, you know, I think about the crazy video communicators that they have. You know, I think about the uniforms with the stripes on the sleeves and, you know, the orange, you know, spacesuits that they wear when they're flying the Eagles. And I think about you know what I mean? Like, that's what makes someone from Moonbase Alpha, and that's what makes it a part of Space 1999. The more you take those things away, the more it's just a random sci-fi show. It could be anything.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Because I'm very confused by the marketing, and I'm not sure where they want to go. So we'll just have to see.
So we have one more news segment. Want to talk a little bit more about other things that are happening. So tell me, Eric, is there anything else that you want to discuss here before we get into our main topic?
Well, I did want to give a shout out to one of our supporters on Twitter, and that is Orville Nation, and that is @Nation_Orville. That's Orville Nation on Twitter. They've actually been very nice to us, and they had a lot of coverage of the Orville for New York Comic Con. Specifically, they actually recorded the panel, and they have several clips available for people to view. They're a really good site. They're becoming one of the premier Orville fan sites, and we haven't really gotten into the Orville on this show, but I have seen several episodes myself, and the episodes that I saw were excellent. I think there's a lot of great potential for the Orville. Actually, as we get more into the streaming wars, which we've talked about and alluded to quite a bit, that is something I want to talk about with the Orville being moved to Hulu. But I did hear this is one thing that apparently in the rumor mill, there was a thing where they were saying that because of the move, the Orville episodes were going to be anywhere from like 3 to 4 minutes longer. And apparently at New York City Comic-Con, they said they're actually going to be about 10 minutes longer. So that's some interesting news on the Orville side.
No, that's pretty cool. I watched all of the first season of Orville, and I've watched part of the second season. And I don't have a good reason for not being up to date on Orville other than sometimes with shows that I'm not watching as they actually air, I sometimes get behind. So...
Well, Orville had some major scheduling problems. You're aware of that, right? Where it would be on 1 week and then it wouldn't be on for 2 weeks, that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah, especially in the later episodes. That's when I got on. I started watching Orville midway through, I think, the second season. So I've seen like 6 or 7 episodes, and they're all the most recent ones. I was aware of it before, and I had seen bits and pieces of the first season, but most of what I've seen is actually the later episodes.
I quite liked the first season, and I liked the little security officer lady a lot. Like, I thought she was a really interesting character, and it reminded me of callback to older science fiction. There's I think it's the beginning of Planet of the Slave Women, but I could be totally wrong. But there's that episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century where it starts off with Buck and Wilma are track this guy down and basically bring him to justice. And he's like a really small, diminutive man. But on his homeworld, the gravity and everything is so much greater that when he's in a more Earth-type environment, he's like a literal Superman.
I believe that's the Gary Coleman episode, isn't it? When they're trying to find Gary Coleman, he's the president of some planet, and the guy who's going after him, isn't that his henchman? He's like an old man who lives on a heavy gravity planet.
It might be. It might be.
We'll have to do a Buck Rogers thing one of these days.
Oh, sure.
Because that'd be fun too. But yeah, I do remember that character. I just don't remember the context exactly myself. But yeah, there was this diminutive old man, and he literally could just throw Buck around like he was a rag doll because he was from a high gravity planet. And I did think that was a really interesting idea. They actually did the opposite of that on a Deep Space Nine episode.
No, yeah, but yeah, whenever I watch the Orville with the security officer, it always reminds me of that. And I love that idea from being a kid watching Buck Rogers. So seeing that idea brought forward in a slightly different format in a science fiction show, I was like, well, that's really cool. I like that. It's fun. I want to talk a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about CW with the Crisis here a little bit because I'm very excited about that. But before we do that, I did get a chance to see Joker over this last weekend. And
yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very curious about your thoughts.
Well, without any spoilers, I would say that Todd Phillips has created a pretty interesting and amazing film. When you talk about like the DC canon of films, it's artistically it's amazing. Joaquin Phoenix's performance as the Joker is mesmerizing. They really kind of suck you into that kind of 1980s, into the 90s universe that I wasn't expecting, and I was kind of surprised by, because I'm like, well, that's weird, but interesting. It's quite good, but it's at the same point, it's very bleak. It's very downbeat. He doesn't really kind of become the Joker until you're basically ramping up towards the end of the movie. But at the same point, I was so entranced by what I was seeing, I didn't necessarily feel like it had a lag or it was slow.
Well, here's something that I heard from people that actually enjoyed it, but they still had a major gripe. And I'm kind of paraphrasing what they said, so if I mess up the meaning, I apologize, but I think I'll get it across. Some people were upset because they felt that the film was good and they felt that this was like a really interesting sort of character study, but they just didn't like the implications to the Joker itself. Kind of like the Joker maybe wasn't quite, like, it's not necessarily, in other words, you're saying it's a good movie, but not a good Joker movie. What do you think of that?
Well, and that's where I was about to head with my comment and criticism of the film. I was going to say this. Last episode, we talked about the concept of the three Jokers. Okay? So if the Joaquin Phoenix Joker is the original person to don this persona, if he's the originator of the Joker, like the first one, the one that sparked what it is that people pick up the mantle and run with, this movie is a very interesting origin story. As a character study of this particular character and this particular version of the Joker, it's very, very interesting. But the idea, because there's a lot of people talking about, oh, a sequel and Batman in a similar environment and whatever. And it's like, no. No, literally, if Batman was introduced into this world in a very deliberate way, and he came into conflict with this version of the Joker, you've heard those jokes where, you know, Batman just runs around beating up the mentally ill.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's literally what the sequel would be. It's basically Batman with a bunch of gadgets and martial arts training beating up someone who's essentially mentally ill. I mean, it really wouldn't be, in my mind, anything more than that. Because this is not the criminal mastermind Joker. That kind of a mantle or an identity. But I just can't see this particular version of the Joker being a match or a foil or the opposite side of the coin to Batman. And if he was the opposite coin to a version of Batman, it'd be a very, very, very different from Batman that we're familiar with. That being said, I could see them doing a really interesting adaptation of Year One. I can't see Batman and this version of the Joker coming into conflict because he's just not the criminal mastermind. He just isn't. So that's...
Yeah, a lot of what I'm hearing from people that actually really liked the movie was, yeah, it's good for what it is. They're a bit like, well, but I don't want to see more in terms of the bigger Batman world because he doesn't fit. That's kind of what I've heard.
Yeah.
So I'll make my own decision when I see it. But that's what I'm hearing even from people that are praising the movie. So.
Yeah, and I would have to say I agree with them as a one-off Joker movie, as a character study. The way it's been sold and presented and the way that it's put together, it's really great and it's very interesting. But the idea of a sequel and going further into this world and having him come into conflict with Batman, I don't know about that. I don't know how you do that. You'd almost have to do another Joker movie and ramp him up before you introduce Batman and have him come into conflict with in potentially like a third movie. Because right now, if you just take this character and set him loose on the streets and have him come into conflict with Batman, that'd be kind of mean-spirited. So, in my mind, anyway. But talking about the larger DC Universe again, a lot of fun, interesting pictures continuing to come out of the Crisis event coming up that's going to be on the CW. I did watch the pilot episode of Batwoman on the CW app, and I kind of liked it, but at the same point it I don't know if it quite clicked with me necessarily. I quite like the character of Batwoman, but I think it's going to take a couple episodes before they kind of get their feet under them, you know what I mean, and they kind of get it all figured out. But it was interesting.
I need to check out the CW app one of these days, because I can at least commit myself to watching the first episode of Batwoman, and I am interested in the Crisis event, I probably need to get on that.
And I was just going to say the thing I had forgotten about with Crisis is that Crisis is crossing over into Black Lightning. It had almost pretty much escaped me. And more really cool photos coming out as they're filming it. And one of the ones that I quite enjoyed, there was two. One of them was, again, it's the Supergirl version of Superman with the Brandon Routh Kingdom Come Superman standing with, I think his name is Grant Gustin, the actor that plays the Flash. And they're all in costumes.
Say again, this is the which version of what?
Okay, so it's the, again, it's, I think his name is Tyler, I don't know how to pronounce his name, like Hoechlin or something? He's the actor who plays Superman in the Supergirl television series. Yeah, because it's a slightly different version of Superman. And then we have Brandon Routh, who played Superman in Superman Returns, who's basically playing the Kingdom Come version of Superman, which I do believe is going to basically be the Christopher Reeve, essentially, era of Superman, just older, okay?
Okay, so you're talking about the Superman from Supergirl.
Exactly.
And Flash, and the Brandon Routh, the new Brandon Routh version of Superman.
Yeah, and they're all standing together, and I thought that was kind of fun.
I'm looking at that picture right now.
Yeah, that's a fun picture. It's just something I never thought I'd see. You know, two versions of Superman standing with Flash. You know, that's cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
And then
I will admit that's cool.
And then they had a teaser actually for the current season of Flash for an episode that's coming up, and then they're going to give us a glimpse of something from Crisis, and Barry is with the other Barry Allen, John Wesley Shipp, who played Flash in the 90s show. And Barry has the Jay Garrick, the original Flash's helmet on. And they're doing some kind of experiment. He has a flash of what's going to be happening. Well, pardon the pun. He has a flash of something that's going to be happening like in the future. He sees a vision of the future. So it looks really interesting. I'm really just really looking forward to all this. So
does that mean the first piece of this story is coming up pretty soon?
Well, I know that it's this event should be, I think, actually starting in December, but I think they're going to start teasing and hinting at things, you know what I mean, to kind of set the stage. And I think they're going to be doing that mostly in Flash, because Flash is the show where they introduce the idea of the multiverse as far as the Arrowverse or the CW shows is anyway. The Flash is the one character who can go back and forth, and he's been doing it in his show for quite some time.
Yeah, that's I'm aware of that part. I did see enough of The Flash that I'm aware that, the multiverse is a big part of The Flash show.
Right. So, but it's, again, to me, it's just crazy to see, you know, John Wesley Shipp as Flash, you know, talking to the current version of Flash. You know what I mean?
Like, well, he's his father, right?
Well, no, he plays his father, but his father in the show is, well, spoiler alert, if you're not up on The Flash, is dead. Yeah, he's been gone for a little while now. So,
but originally he played his father, correct?
Right. But, and again, spoiler alert, if you are interested in Flash and you haven't watched it, are you sure you want to hear this? He basically, John Wesley Shipp is essentially playing the original Flash. He came from a different part of the multiverse. He's from a different Earth, and he's the original Flash.
Yeah, I've seen the picture of that with the Mercury helmet, right?
Exactly. And that was a big reveal. I think that was season two. That was a big reveal because it was they kind of did a spoof on or kind of explored the idea of the man in the iron mask. And when the mask came off, we all thought we knew who it was going to be. And it turned out it's like, oh, he looks just like your father. And he turns out he's the original Flash.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah,
especially really considering he was the original Flash on screen.
Yeah, and then eventually here in Crisis, they introduced again yet another iteration of him. And of course, it's the same Flash that we watched in the 1990s television series, complete with the red suit and the whole thing, which was really
that's
fun.
Cool. Yeah, I love that, the 90s series.
Yeah, I do too. It's one of my favorites of all the superhero shows they've done. I love the 90s Flash. It looks like in Flash they're going to be teasing and leading up to Crisis, so that's fun. But then another thing I'd forgotten about is that this is all crossing over into Black Lightning, and it's going to bring Black Lightning into the CW universe as well. And I had kind of forgotten about that, but there was a picture that was released, and again, it's Grant Gustin standing next to the gentleman who plays Black Lightning, and I was like, oh, that's right. And it's just, I'm just so excited, and I think it's so cool that they're bringing all these different disparate elements together. And, you know, and I know they can't adapt Crisis the way it was done in the comics because it would cost a fortune and whatever else. But it's just really neat that they're even giving this a shot and that, you know, we're seeing so many, like, again, the opposite of the stuff that they're teasing with the Star Trek stuff where I'm talking about, I look at it, I'm not sure what I'm looking at because no one's in costume. You know what I mean? They're not in environments I understand. Whereas with everything coming out of this Crisis event, it's like, I know exactly who that is. I know who that is. You know what I mean? I never thought I'd see that. That's cool. You know, it's again, seeing that stuff come from the comics and brought to life. And that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, apparently they're also bringing back the Huntress from that Birds of Prey television show, the very short-lived Birds of Prey television show.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and she's... And I'm curious if they'll bring Dina Meyer back as Oracle. I haven't heard anything about it, but that would be an interesting surprise. Because Dina Meyer as Oracle, of course, and if you watch the Birds of Prey television series, they established, of course, that she was actually Batgirl. So it'll be interesting. And that's the thing. It seems like a lot of the Superman stuff, I think, well, seeing Flash there, it's not necessarily localized to Supergirl. I was wondering if all the Superman type stuff, the super family stuff, would stay localized more towards Supergirl, and then maybe a little bit of Legends of Tomorrow, since Brandon Routh was one of the stars of Legends of Tomorrow as the Atom. But I don't know now, because it would make sense to have Huntress, and if Dina Meyer actually is on there briefly as Oracle, it would make sense that those elements of the multiverse would bleed over into Batwoman.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting what they do. I think it's going to be somewhat difficult to keep track of it all too.
Yeah, it will be, and it'll be, you know, it will be. But I think it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it, and you know, as the shows, you know, debut or whatever, it'll be fun. We can talk about them, you know, in the news segment or whatever, or like on the on our show here, and I'll be happy to kind of break down and decode what I'm seeing. You know what I mean? As a longtime DC Comics fan and help figure out, well, I think that's this person and that's person, and maybe it might connect to this, maybe it might connect to that. You know what I mean? And we can kind of speculate and kind of have fun with it. So,
yeah, it's very interesting. And of course, you know, with Brandon Roth, that's kind of what we're leading into with this episode, right?
That's exactly right. In this episode, we're going to be doing the retrospective format. We're going to be talking about Superman Returns. So on this episode, on the retrospective segment, we're going to be talking about, from 2006, the Warner Brothers film Superman Returns. Superman Returns, again, like I said, came out in 2006. It was directed by Bryan Singer. Looks like the box office was $391.1 million, according to the almighty interwebs. So I want to start off by... talking about how we first heard about it. How did you first hear about Superman Returns, Eric?
Well, I was a fan of the Christopher Reeve's Superman movies growing up. I believe I saw every single one of those in the theater, all four of them. And I also own the Richard Donner version of Superman 2. So I'm a little bit of a fan to begin with. And so it was definitely on my radar when it came out that Bryan Singer, who had done the X-Men movies, was going to be doing a Superman movie. I knew all about it, and I was ready to rock and roll and see this thing. So I was right there as it was all coming out, and I was in the middle of it. Like I said, I already liked the Superman films. You know, I already liked what Bryan Singer was doing with X-Men, so I was ready to rock and roll.
Well, and it's interesting, too, with Superman Returns, because the original information I remember coming out, the thing that had a lot of people talking and excited amongst my friends was the fact that we all knew from back in the day when you would get like your DVD of the movies, you know, in the old days. I don't know if people do it as much now, but people would go through and watch all of the behind the scenes content, you know, all the little documentaries and featurettes and that kind of stuff. And when you would attend conventions sometimes like Hall H and San Diego Comic-Con, a lot of that content would actually sometimes be shown as a part of a presentation for a film. They would shoot and produce those pieces and then turn around and show them like during Hall H before they would bring the stars out, right, to talk about the films. So I was very well aware of the fact that one of the things that they were talking about and using as sort of a barometer and a measuring stick for the X-Men films, and Bryan Singer was doing them, the original ones, was they kept talking about the original Superman and the idea of what they called verisimilitude, the idea of it being very grounded and as real as you can make it. And that Superman Returns was one of the films they kept coming back to as an example of a film done right, right? As far as a comic book inspired film. So it's interesting because when I knew that he was a fan of that material, and then as it came out through news releases and whatever, that what they were going to do essentially is if they could try and kind of pick up where the Christopher Reeve movies left off and have it be a continuation. So I was very excited for Superman Returns. I was actually in Hall H when they actually did the presentation, and they showed like the first footage. And Bryan Singer was there. I remember they showed that footage, I think, two or three times. It was something else. And everybody was super, super excited. Pardon the pun. I never mean to make these puns, but I always end up doing it. But everyone was very excited. And they actually gave out little pins of the sort of the Brandon Routh style Superman S. And I usually always have mine on my lanyards whenever I do conventions. It's one of the things I always put on my lanyards is my Superman Returns pin. I was very excited. I knew a lot about it. Like I said, I'd seen the presentation stuff, and I was very eager to see the film. My experience watching the movie the first time was not very great, though, but we'll get into that in a moment. So how did you first see the film?
I saw it in the theater. I don't specifically remember much else about that. Like, I don't remember who I went with or anything like that. But I do remember I saw it in the theater when it came out. I was obviously, like I said, I was obvious intending to see it. I wanted to see it really bad. There was a lot of anticipation. I saw it in the theater. I saw it in the theater.
Very cool. Now, I did see it in the theater as well. I saw it. It was a midnight show. It was one of the first showings we could go to. However, at that time in Prescott Valley, we have, right now in Prescott Valley, we have two basically movie theaters you can go to. One of them is a Harkins Theater that's quite good. And then there's the Picture Show that's excellent that I quite like a lot too. Picture Show we just have two really great options right now, okay? Roll back the hands of time to 2006, and we had two options, but they were not as good. We had Harkins, which was really great, but then we also had the Frontier Village Cinema, which just sucked. It was awful. You know, the projectors were not very good. The sound was awful. The place was, you know, just always in some sort of ill state of repair. For movie theaters, it was okay, but it wasn't as nice as Harkins. And at 2000, and during the period in which Superman Returns was released, I guess they were getting the films from the same basic distribution company. And they had a contract where only one of them could show certain first run release movies. So guess which theater got Superman Returns?
The good one, of course, right?
Of course not. It was the other one that got it. So I was there at a midnight screening. And the door to the theater wouldn't shut all the way. So we had just this line of light on the screen. And,
wow.
It kind of blew out part of the screen too a little bit. So it was like, it was, you know, like the light through the curtain kind of thing. It was really annoying. They decided to vacuum in the hallway while the movie was playing, and the door wouldn't shut right, so we could hear the vacuum cleaner.
Wow.
The sound was bad, so we were hearing this the speakers pop every once in a while. And literally, there's a scene in the film, which I hope everyone's seen Superman Returns. If you haven't, let me just go ahead and tell you right now, I'm going to recommend you go watch it, because I quite like it. But this will be a bit of a spoiler here, so spoiler alert. The scene where Superman is basically at the bedside of the little kid, right? And he's given the whole Jor-El speech, right? I couldn't hear a single friggin' word he was saying. All I heard were the employees in the hallway cutting up, yucking, having a good time, attempting to vacuum the hallway. That's all I could hear.
Wow.
It was awful. It was completely awful. So the next weekend, I was so distraught and had such a horrible experience. My wife and I got together with a different group of friends. We went down to Phoenix and we watched it on an IMAX down there, and it was awesome.
So you actually saw the IMAX version, which is a different version of the film, correct?
Yeah, yeah, it was slightly different. But
it sequence on Krypton, doesn't it?
Yeah, a brief one, but it's actually as he's on his way to Krypton. It's just a brief scene with him in this suit, like in the ship or whatever. But it was just really interesting. It was like that. So literally the weekend that Superman Returns came out, I saw it twice that weekend, opening weekend. Once was an amazing, great experience, which again was a Harkins Theater down in Phoenix, and they had the IMAX screen showing, which was awesome. Everything about that experience was amazing. And then I saw it up here at what that time was called the Frontier Village Cinema, which was one of the worst movie-going experiences I've ever had.
Did you ask for your money back?
You know, I wanted to, but I was so angry I just left, because I know how I am when I'm that mad. When I'm that mad, I just need to just see my way out of the situation, because I've got nothing good to say, and if you make it worse, you know what I mean? It's just not good. Nothing good will come of that. So that was how I saw.
I have to wonder, you know, with such a terrible experience like that, what did you do? You remember what you thought of the film walking out of the theater then, or were you just so upset about everything else you couldn't even think about the movie?
I didn't know how to feel about the movie. There was some stuff that I thought was really great. I love the scene with the space shuttle. I love that. I thought that was really cool and fun. I really liked that scene. There was some other stuff, like, again, because we were having such a hard time hearing the dramatic moments when people were talking, like when Lois and Superman are talking on the rooftop and she's having the whole, well, where did you go? You know, that whole conversation they had. I couldn't hear most of it. So for me, a lot of why he left and what was going on was a bit of a mystery, because I didn't have enough information to even completely understand what the film was totally about. I mean, I got the major beats, you know what I mean? You know, Lex Luthor goes and steals the crystals and uses them because he thinks it's technology and the land scam thing. You know, I mean, I got all the major beats, you know what I mean? Because a lot of information is communicated visually, but the kind of more dramatic moments between Lois and Superman, I couldn't hear what they were saying. And then when we get to the scene where it's kind of revealed that basically that's his son and he's giving him the Jor-El speech, I didn't know it was his son. I was still slightly confused. It's like, I think it's his son. I'm not sure. Did he throw the piano? Did he not throw the piano? Like, what the hell's going on? Like, I was still pretty confused. So I walked out literally like going, I just saw that movie and didn't see that movie at the same time. And I didn't have any hatred for the film. I just was very aggravated because I was so excited to go see it. And I felt like I had a lot of major questions that still weren't answered. And then there was some performances I wasn't too sure about, because I didn't know how to feel about Kate Bosworth, because I honestly didn't hear enough of her performance to even understand if she was even a decent Lois Lane or not.
Right.
To me, she was just kind of, you know, mumbling at the screen, you know, and I was like, I don't know if that works or not, you know. So I just didn't know how to feel about it at all. And then the second time we saw it, I actually did see the movie. And then I got all the dramatic moments, and I liked it. I didn't like it as much as some of the other Superman films. Like, I didn't like it as much, obviously, the original Christopher Reeve Superman, the Richard Donner, the classic one from 78 or 79 with Gene Hackman. Like, I didn't like it as much as that one, obviously. That's a classic to me in my mind. I didn't like as much Superman 2, but to me, it's on a similar par as, like, Superman 3, you know? Like, I liked it because there's a lot of things I love about Superman 3. But then Superman 3 has some weird beats for me, you know what I mean? But I still quite enjoy it. And then Superman 4, Quest for Peace, it's a hard film to watch, but there's still some things I like about it. But so I knew walking out after seeing it that time that, you know, I didn't like it as much as the first two Superman movies, but I'd put it on a similar par with Superman 3. And there was some things about it I totally loved. One of the things I remember watching the film I thought totally worked is I really liked Brandon Routh as Superman, and I really liked him as Clark. I know for some people, even then, it was a bit disconcerting because it's so similar at times to Christopher Reeve, that some people that it almost kind of took them out of the film a little bit. You know what I mean? But I liked that.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that, that they were trying to pick up the legacy of those Superman films and then try to push that narrative forward. I loved that idea. You know, Kevin Spacey is Lex Luthor. I remember then watching it, there was some things I loved about his performance, and there was some things about it that I was just like, I'm not sure, you know, because that Gene Hackman performance of Luthor is so unique, I think, to Gene Hackman, that it was hard for me to imagine someone else doing that, but I still liked him as Lex Luthor a lot. And then I think,
what did you think? Because you touched on it, but what, because it was a big deal at the time too. Initially, if you can go back in time,
what did you think about the Lex Luthor premise being another real estate deal?
Because
that's actually one of the big criticisms of the original Superman, even. What did you think about that specific idea and at that time?
Well, in the original one, I love it. I think it works great. In Superman Returns, it does feel like a bit of a retread, you know what I mean, of the first movie to an extent. But the way they get there is completely different. I mean, in a sense, it kind of makes sense that the guy obsessed with land would still be obsessed with land, you know, now. I do think if the film had expanded the Superman lore a little bit more, and, you know, maybe we had had some other Superman elements introduced, I think the diehard fans, as well as the casual moviegoers, I think might have been more likely to go along with it. Because I've always heard, after all these years, and especially then, the criticism of the idea. It's like, wow, he's still obsessed with trying to pull off a land scheme, you know, scam. You know what I mean? This is the same thing. You know what I mean?
Well, this is the angle that I came at it, because at the time, the Superman animated series was in full swing, okay, or had been in full swing. The one that was actually tied into the Batman animated series, the 90s Superman animated series. That's where actually I get a lot of the more current Superman lore, because I was more familiar with, say, Silver Age and Golden Age type Superman ideas, okay?
Right.
So I didn't even understand what they had done with Lex Luthor until I saw the animated series, in terms of Lex Luthor was now in charge of LexCorp. He was now a successful businessman. He was rich and powerful, right? And at first, when I saw Superman Returns, and I saw the scene with Noelle Neal, where she's dying and she's this heiress, right? And she's super rich. And I thought, okay, they're going to do the rich Lex, but they're going to do it in a different way. And then they didn't do it. You see what I'm saying? And I was like, why didn't they do it? Why didn't they make Lex into this? He's now rich. He's got like unlimited resources, apparently. You know, you could say how she was, you know, heiress to whatever. You're getting him there a different way, but you're keeping within the continuity, because one of the interesting things about Superman Returns is it is a true reboot, because they actually were trying to do the continuation of the previous Superman films while ignoring Superman 3 and Superman 4. So it was like an actual, like, true reboot. And it's just kind of interesting. Like, they kind of gave themselves an out where they could make Lex Luthor different and sort of put in more of the current lore, and then they just didn't do it.
I think it's just an example of, and I can't speak from too much certainty, but I just think they were such fans of the original Richard Donner film that in a weird way they were kind of handcuffed by their love of that film, you know, and trying to recreate in a different story in their mind anyway, still kind of have similar kind of story beats and have the characters still be kind of in that same vein or that same mode, you know? And I think that's what they were trying to do. I think in some ways it's almost like they're, and I remember thinking this at the time as my friends were complaining about the land scam thing. I think that in a weird way they were almost, you know, it's the same criticism that you hear about Watchmen. You know, it's like it's too devoted to the source material and it's not different enough. You know, I think that in this sense it's kind of like that. It's like you get so caught up in capturing the vibe and the feel and the beat of those characters that you love that you sometimes maybe forget to maybe change them enough. But it's interesting because when you look at what's happened to Superman, it's to an extent it is a pretty big change, you know. And then when you look at what it adds to the Superman mythos, as far as the films are concerned, you know, the idea that he has a son, you know what I mean? Those are
that
pretty
big things.
That was
huge for me at the time. At the time. And by the way, I got it the second that we had the piano scene. I mean, it was, I didn't have the audio issues and things that you had. I was like, oh my God. Back in time, I remember that moment. I was like, oh my God, Superman has a son? That was just mind-boggling to me.
No, yeah, it was. And I really liked that idea, because that's where the film, I felt like, kind of was forming its own path, you know what I mean? And kind of beginning to add to the mythos and create its own lore. Because when you talk about Superman's son, if you're looking at the classic where you're talking about silver, golden age stories or whatever, whether you're talking about how later iterations, like the current one, whether we're talking about Rebirth or New 52, we're looking at the idea of, you know, Superman's son as essentially Superboy. There's a lot of material. There's a lot of different ways you can go. But before we get too far into where they could have gone, I think that definitely should be like covered in our next segment. But I remember at the time I quite enjoyed the film. And even though some of my friends didn't care for it quite as much, I really liked it then, rather enjoyed it once I actually got the chance to actually kind of really see and hear it. So at the time, how did you feel about the film?
I was impressed with it. I really liked it. Again, the moment with the revelation of the sun was just absolutely intriguing to me. That's what really hooked me. Not Luthor. Again, I had that bias from the animated series. I was like, I'm not liking what you're doing here. I'm not liking where you're going. I think you gave yourself an out. You could have gone there, and you didn't. And I can almost imagine that in some sort of production meeting, somebody that was aware of where Lex is in the comics and the animated series at that time, somebody said something about that. He's like, hey, he's supposed to be rich now. And somebody decided, okay, well, let's make him rich, but let's not do anything with that. You know what I mean? So that's how I took it at the time. But I was overall impressed with the film.
So we were just talking about Superman Returns and how we felt about the film when it originally debuted in 2006. It is now 2019, a little while later. I, in my mind, thought a lot later than that, but a little while later, but not as long ago as I thought it was. Anyhow, so we're talking about Superman Returns. So tell me, Eric, having recently, we both rewatched it today to talk about how we feel about the film. How do you feel about Superman Returns today?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I haven't actually watched it in quite a long time. And it's a funny thing to say because I do own it. It is in my personal collection. Whereas Man of Steel is not. So Superman Returns, I own a copy of it. And obviously, as I mentioned, my initial response was very positive. And that's one of the reasons I have it. That's why it's in my collection. But seeing it again, I was actually surprised how much I still like it, especially since I don't watch it that often. I really think it's a pretty good, solid movie. I still have the concern about the real estate deal and actually Lex's portrayal in general. I will say, it has to be kind of said, but there is a sort of taintness factor in terms of the scandal that both Kevin Spacey and Brian Singer have gone through, and the state that their careers are in right now. And it's kind of hard to watch the movie right now without thinking about those things. But overall, I think Brandon Roth's portrayal to me is a great homage and a great tribute to Christopher Reeves, which to me, Christopher Reeves is like my on-screen Superman. So I appreciate what he did with the role. Again, the thing about him having a kid, just I feel like that's such a wasted storyline because they never did anything with that. That there could have been so much potential about Superman's kid.
No, yeah, I totally agree. That's kind of one of the things. A lot of the fans of this film, or just Superman fans in general, feel like that Superman Returns, because a lot of them will say Superman Returns is a pretty solid film. You know, whether you like it as much, like I quite like the film a lot. But even amongst the kind of more kind of not as big, you know, pendant fans or whatever for this particular Superman film as the other ones, a lot of them still say that they liked a lot about it and they would have loved to have seen a sequel to see what they would have done next. And it's a shame that that's not what they did, because I think that next film probably would have clicked with people a lot better because it would have involved more new things. You know what I mean?
I can't agree with you more. This is really a good example of a film that potentially could have had a much better sequel.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, we talk a lot about Trek in a sense. I think this potentially that sequel could have been the difference between, you know, Motion Picture and Wrath of Khan. And I would say that when you look at Bryan Singer's work specifically, you know, the first X-Men film he did was very, very good. But then you look at X2, and for the longest time, X2 is one of my favorite superhero comic book like films of all time. It's so good. And I think that's in a weird way, I was so looking forward to the film that might have followed Superman Returns, because there's so much great things in this that I could totally see them just completely knocking out of the park with the next film. From my particular perspective, the unfortunate things that are going on, the sort of, I don't know, the unpleasantness with, you know, Brian Singer and Kevin Spacey, what is or isn't true, I don't know. I haven't gotten too far into that because, I'll be honest with you, I just chose not to, just because the more you're aware of that, the more it taints the things that you might like. You know, like you were saying earlier, I'm aware of some of it, but I'm not aware of all of it. And it's just because I just chose to kind of not get too far into whatever all that is. Okay. But it is something that should be mentioned and addressed, you know, and it's kind of the thing that hangs around this film now, you know what I mean? So it has to be mentioned. But beyond that, the things that I think are really great about this film because I quite like Superman Returns a lot. Actually, for me, at the time that I had originally seen it, I was thinking it's kind of in that Superman 3, you know, like, because there's a lot of things I like about Superman 3. But what's interesting is as time has continued to move on, I like Superman 3 a lot. Like, to me, Superman 3 is kind of up there with Superman 2 now. So, you know, Superman 2, Superman 3, and Superman Returns, they're kind of all jockeying for position. You know what I mean? But ironically, sometimes for me, Superman 3 and Returns is sometimes a little eclipsing Superman 2 a little bit here and there. But that's just for my personal taste. But I loved, and at that time, I still like to this day, I thought Brandon Routh did a great job as Superman. It's weird because there's some things about the way that they did his suit, for example, that it's a little off-putting, but at the same point, I really like it because it feels very evocative in its own way of the way Superman looked when he originally debuted in the 40s. You know what I mean? There's just something about it. I don't know how they did that, but it captures that that kind of vibe, which is really unique, at least for this particular film. Because a lot of the other versions of Superman, they don't really capture that original, you know what I mean, look. But at the same point, it's not slavishly, you know, trying to recreate the original look of Superman. But there's just something about the proportions and how they did it, and it's very evocative of, at least in my mind anyway, the way Superman looked when he originally debuted.
Well, they actually film Superman's debut, the famous cover, you know, is in the movie, you know, where he has the car above his head and everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But there's just something about the kind of the cut of the suit and how they put it together that he's very evocative of that particular original Superman. It's really unique because so much of the film is so kind of, again, like I said, like slavish to Richard Donner's version of Superman. And, you know, Christopher Reeve's suit is very much, while classic, is probably more in that Garcia Lopez, Kurt Swan, you know what I mean, like style. So it's very interesting in this film, with everything else is so kind of on point with the Chris Reeve Superman, that with the suit, they've managed to capture a vibe that's, you know, the original first appearance. You know what I mean? It's just, it's kind of unique what they did there. But no, I think Brandon Routh is great as Superman. I like the idea, again, the introduction of the sun. You know what I mean? Some amazing, amazing sequences. When you're talking about, you know, Superman saving the space shuttle, that sequence is great. I like the one where he's flying through the city when the city's experiencing the earthquake.
Right.
And he does all the cool different stuff where he's flying down and putting out the explosive fires, you know, down in the...
You mean he's actually saving people?
Yes, he's saving people in this movie.
As opposed to another Superman film where he's not doing that?
That's true. Yes, he's very concerned about what's happening to the people in this movie.
I see that as a huge contrast between Man of Steel and Superman Returns. And that really hit me when I was watching it, because it's one of the things that, even coming out of the theater, when I saw Man of Steel, I was like, what the hell was Superman doing? You know what I mean? How many people died?
Right.
That's not Superman. Superman saves people. That's like, you can't get more basic than that. That's what Superman is. He rescues people. If you're going to have a situation where Superman doesn't rescue someone, you know, it's got to be like, that should be like an entire story just by itself. You know, to me, it's like that's just the bread and butter of what he does. And that really hit me when I was watching it, Superman Returns. It really hit me how he's saving people, you know, and he, you know, in contrast to Man of Steel.
No, yeah, and it's interesting too, because they showcase the different ways he's saving people too. I love the part where he kind of flies upside down and he uses heat vision, and he literally burns all of the glass that's falling out of the building, so
yeah,
he doesn't hit any of the people on the street. I mean, he's very much concerned with protecting everyone, you know, to the point that he's flying out to deal with Lex Luthor and figure out what's going on and stop this. But when he sees that earthquake headed towards Metropolis and he realizes what's going to happen, he turns right around and takes care of the people first, you know.
And also think about it this way. He's also, you know, Lois Lane is obviously the love of his life, and obviously he wants to save her more than anybody else. I mean, that's bread and butter stuff of Superman as well. But the core of the character, to me, it's like, okay, I want to save Lois, but she's one person, and the entire city is in jeopardy right now. So what does he do? He does the right thing. He goes and saves the city, right? That's a no-brainer.
Right.
That's
right.
That is a no-brainer decision for Superman.
Yeah, and it's a great sequence, too. But no, like I said, those are some of the things to me that really stand out and really hold up from this film. And it is, you know, there's when we'll compare it to Man of Steel, since we've started down this path. There's some things about Man of Steel that I really like. I quite like a lot of the Krypton stuff. I think it's really kind of interesting. Even stylistically, some of the designs for the costumes and stuff, they're a little bit more evocative of, at the time period, a lot of the cartoonists were heavily inspired and influenced by Flash Gordon, and specifically the original Flash Gordon that was being illustrated by Alex Raymond. So when you look at a lot of those costumes and everything, it's very interesting. It's very evocative of that period, you know what I mean? While at the same point being a little bit of an update. And those are the things I quite like about Man of Steel. And there's some other things.
There's some of that imagery in the original Superman as well, right? The Kryptonian guards, they're very like Flash Gordon, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, but I don't think it's quite... There's kind of an ornate nature, you know what I mean, to how they approach it in Man of Steel that I think in some ways brings it a little bit closer when you look at the kind of work Alex Raymond was doing with Flash Gordon. And that's what I'm talking about. These are some of the things I like about Man of Steel. And then there's some other things that even though I understand the logic behind why, it still, I remember being in the theater and still to this day, I still don't know how to feel about it. I know I don't like it, but I don't want to come down on the film too hard. But that scene with the tornado, I still don't know how to feel about that.
Oh, I hate it. I absolutely hate it. That's not Superman. Superman would never do that. But my point is that's not Pa Kent either. Kevin Costner was not Pa Kent. I'm sorry. I don't care what anybody says. That was not Pa Kent. That's not, he's not cynical like that. The whole point of the Kents is that they're optimistic. They are apple pie. That's the whole reason why, you know, Superman is being raised in the Midwest by these childless parents. That's a huge part of the mythos, is that these are good, wholesome people, optimistic, hardworking people. That guy in Man of Steel, I don't know who he was.
Yeah, and there's the scene with the tornado. I never know how to feel about that. There's moments where I quite like what Michael Shannon is doing with Zod. But at the same point, too, as we move throughout the film, as we get closer to the resolution, while I think that Man of Steel shows the level of destruction that beings with Superman's power level, if they were having it out, you know, like full-on physical confrontation, I think we're seeing the level of devastation that would be created, you know. But at the same point, too, the lack of non-concern at times is definitely, at the very least, a little disconcerting.
It's the whole point of Batman versus Superman. Even they use that for the next movie. That's the reason Batman hates Superman, is because he let all these people die, and that's the reason. That's his motivation. That's right. Why he hates Superman, because he let all those... In a way, Zack Snyder was kind of brilliant, because he's like, he took all that that fan outrage and said, okay, well, I'll make Batman like you guys. That's what he did.
Right.
Now, what's interesting about, you talk about General Zod. I actually really liked the twist at the beginning of Man of Steel, that General Zod was basically kind of on the same side as Jor-El. But he was coming at it from a completely different angle. He was saying, we need a military coup, that kind of a thing. But he actually was on board that the planet was dying. He was trying to save it. I thought that was a neat twist. I really liked that.
No,
but I do find it interesting, comparing the two in terms of the villains of these two movies and their goals. They're actually very similar, because Lex Luthor was trying to turn the Earth essentially into Krypton. And that's what Zod does in Man of Steel.
You know, and that's the things that always make me wonder, because are you a fan of Kevin Smith at all?
Yes. Yeah, I'm familiar with like Mallrats and Chasing Amy and all that stuff, yeah.
Did you ever see any of the original, like the Evening with Kevin Smith stuff?
I don't think so, no.
Well, in this first one, he talks a lot about... being brought on to do some treatments for, I think, what eventually would have become Superman Lives, which would have been the Nicolas Cage Superman movie at one point that they were working on, right?
Right.
That they abandoned before they actually ended up doing Superman Returns, actually with Brandon Routh as Superman. But what is interesting is the producer behind the film has these ideas, and he's holding on to these ideas, right? because they're great ideas. And then eventually some of these ideas play out in other films, like, you know, Will Smith's Wild Wild West. You know what I mean? For example, people that are familiar with the evening of Kevin Smith know exactly what I'm talking about. But what's interesting is I always wonder, it's like, was this just a great idea that someone at Warner's just thought would be great for a Superman movie? And they go, well, it didn't work in Superman Returns, but it'd still be a good idea to do again. So let's keep it on the docket for the next Superman movie, you know? And then when they come in and the writers or whoever are pitching their ideas, it's like, that's great, but you know it'd be really cool if he's trying to turn the Earth into Krypton.
You know, like it's called institutional memory. You know, it's that's those ideas that get recycled. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's just, it's a really weird thing. And, yeah, it's just, it's really strange. I mean, now using a terraforming device as a weapon on the planet, but at the same point, you're trying to create a world for your people. I think that kind of works for Zod's motivation. You know what I mean? And it gives a lot of power to that moment where he talks about, you know, he was created, you know what I mean, to protect, you know, Krypton, you know. And because that's one of the things I like about Michael Shannon's Zod is completely different than Terrence Stamp's Zod from Superman 2, like completely. And Terrence Stamp's Zod, I think, will always be in my mind like the definitive version of General Zod. But
that's which one? I'm sorry. I have trouble with the actors' names. Which Zod are you saying is definitive?
The original one from Superman 2.
Yes, that's what I think as well. Yeah.
The British guy.
Yeah. Yes. But that's I love Superman 2.
Yeah, and I love Superman 2 as well. And I think his version of Zod will always be the definitive version. But there's some scenes with Michael Shannon as Zod that I really, really like. Some just kind of chew the scene actory type moments. And I love that whole bit where he's talking about how, you know, his whole purpose for being, you know what I mean, is to protect Krypton and his people. And he's like, and now I have no people, you know what I mean, before he unleashes his final assault on Superman. There's some things about that performance that I quite like. But just this year, it's one of those things that's like, I remember sitting there in the theater thinking it, and then even when I revisit Man of Steel, you know, every once in a blue moon, because I had seen it in preparation before going and seeing like Batman v Superman, and then I said seen it again too before I went and saw Justice League as those movies were coming out. The level of devastation in Man of Steel is shocking, because I'll never forget, I was sitting in the movie theater and they've been fighting all this time, and then they're just kind of hovering, staring at each other, and there's nothing but rubble everywhere. And I'm like, is anyone still alive? Like,
no, I think it's gross. It's just, honestly, for a Superman film, I think it's gross. I mean, you should be, if that's a situation, it should be like Superman is totally defeated and is almost dying and all that kind of stuff. Like, it should just be like, yeah, I don't like that at all. I mean, I just don't get it. That's not Superman to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. But getting back to Superman Returns, those are the reasons that I feel like that for me, Superman Returns, holds a special place, because, I like Superman Returns more than Man of Steel. I really do. I quite like the film. You know, the things aside that are either unpleasant because of recent events, or the things about the film that feel like a little bit of a retread, whether it's Luther's motivation or whatever. There's so many new things that I really like about Superman Returns, and it's part of the reason I'm so excited to see Brandon Routh return as Superman for this CW Crisis event, is because of how much I enjoyed his version of Superman. And so I'm very much hoping, really hoping, fingers crossed, that this Kingdom Come version of Superman will essentially be a continuation, in a sense, of that classic Superman legacy. You know what I mean?
Wouldn't it be crazy if he has a son?
No, yeah, it would be.
Wouldn't that be like a really cool twist? I mean, I don't think they'll do it because it doesn't have anything to do with Crisis of Infinite Earths, but wouldn't that be like a huge twist if We see the, you know, Brandon Roth's new version of Superman, and he has a son.
No, I mean, in all honesty, I don't know if they'll do it. But not just that, but I think it would be, it would be a great way to introduce and give us a fun moment that I don't think we'll ever see again. It might be the last time we actually see it on film or in television. If, you know, at some point Superboy shows up and it is his son, because in the rebirth and the newer comics, his, you know, biological son is the new Superboy. So it'd be a great way to introduce the concept and the idea of Superboy in a classic Superman suit. You know what I mean? Essentially, even if it's a brief moment, I think that would be really, really cool. I mean, I just think it would be amazing. I don't know if the writers and the producers are thinking along those lines, but at the same point too, even if it was pitched in the story meeting, I mean, when you look at everything they're trying to do, I don't know how great the chance is that they could work that in. I mean, when you're talking about all the things they want to do, the scope of this is incredible. You know what I mean? When you're talking about taking, you know, Burt Ward and somehow having him represent that 60s era of Batman, you know what I mean? Even in a brief moment, you know, figuring out how to work that in. You know what I mean?
No, that's going to be awesome. I'm hoping that's going to be awesome.
Oh, yeah. I am already impressed and happy with the fact that they're even trying to do it. And I think it's going to be really cool. And I have a feeling it's going to be something special. The carrot with which that they capture the classic Superman and how they created that costume for him of the Kingdom Come Superman. Cause it's really cool because it's like, again, I look at Superman Returns. There's something about the cut of that costume and the way they put it together, and it just harkens back to Superman, you know, when he debuted, when we're talking about, you know, 1938 into the 1940s, like that original suit. There's just something about that suit that works, and it captures that feel. And then that there's a shot that's not as popular that's been making the rounds of Brandon Routh in the Kingdom Come outfit, where he's got his hands on his hips. And again, because of how they've crafted and created that suit, it feels very much, even though it's the Kingdom Come Superman, it feels like the Kurt Swan Superman. You know, there's just something about it. It harkens to that. So I'm really jazzed. I just think it's really cool they're even trying to do this. So I'm really excited for it. And it was fun to watch, because I do feel like that Superman Returns, in a sense, could be part of your preparation to get ready for this CW Crisis event. Because I do think that Brandon Routh will be playing, even in the Kingdom Come version, I think he will essentially represent the classic version of Superman that so many of us grew up with, where you're talking about, you know, the Silver Age comics into the 70s, the 80s, of course, the great Christopher Reeve films. You know what I mean? I think he's going to represent that idea. And if
don't
they
forget
do
the Super
right,
Friends. Don't forget Super Friends.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's got to be some Super Friends.
For sure. For sure. And if they do it right, the other thing that would be nice, too, is it'll help establish that the Supergirl, because I've always felt this way, that the Supergirl version of Superman is very much like the new 52 kind of, you know what I mean, version of Superman. And I think it'll help for everyone to latch on and you know, kind of be, because I feel like that sometimes he gets a little bit of the short end of the stick, and I think everyone's a little bit too mean, you know what I mean, with his version of Superman. But I think he very much represents the new guard, you know what I mean? And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that having a more classic version of Superman next to him in those moments, I think will help everyone kind of see kind of the turf that they represent, and cast that Superman, in my mind anyway, in a better light too, I think. So, but again, you know, I'm a diehard DC fan and I got my rose-colored glasses on, so I'm probably seeing things that aren't there. But if I was in a writer's room, that's what I would be looking to do. I would look at this as an opportunity to actually put that Superman even on a better footing than he's on right now. You know what I mean? And show, you know, what he can represent even in the same classic Superman ideals, but have it be that where people can better understand, oh, that's the role. oh, okay, that's the part he's, I get it. You know what I mean? And be a little bit more accepting of what he's doing with his portrayal and everything. Because I quite like the guy who plays the Supergirl version of Superman. Whenever he shows up on the show, I usually watch it. I don't know. I'm just really excited about all this. And I, like I said, I do feel like that Superman Returns could be a great kind of, you know, a different place to start when you're getting ready to watch the CW Crisis event. I mean, I think watching some 90s Flash, you know what I mean, would be good too, you know, and kind of acquainting yourself with the characters. So if you're not familiar, just so that when they have their moment on screen, if there's a fun nod, you might be able to pick that out a little bit easier. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. Again, my name is Dave Beatty, and I've been one of your hosts. If you're interested to learn more about me, see some of the art and the things I've created, definitely go check out my website, davebeatty.com. That's www.davebeatty.com. All kinds of fun stuff going on there. Definitely check that out. I want to thank for being back again. My fabulous co-host, this is Mr. Eric Alexander. Eric, please tell the people where to find you on the interwebs.
As always, you can find me on Twitter. It's at BassGod14, at BassGod14 on Twitter. I'm very active there and love to interact with people. I also have the same, I use the same avatar for YouTube. Which hopefully we might actually have some new content on there. I try to do some supplemental videos. Again, that's BassGod14 on YouTube. And as always, please check out Bad Bob Productions.